Well, my guest in the studio tonight studied in Canberra, Amsterdam and Sydney. He plays the trombone with the Jazz Groove Mothership Orchestra and Ben Walsh's Krusty Suitcase Band, and has performed and recorded with a wide variety of artists, including Jim McNeely, Shasha Marley, The Herd, The Holland Big Band and Steve Hunter. He's just completed a tour of Australia with his group, the Kaiser McGuinness Quintet, on the back of their debut release, The Seed Habit. Lucien McGuinness, welcome to Now's the Time.
Oh, thanks, Frank.
Firstly, how was the tour? What was the highlight? Where did you go?
Well, I'm sure my band members would agree that one of the highlights was Dainty Szechuan in Melbourne. We had a great meal there. And it's really hard to say, actually. I mean, we had a great time at every gig. Honestly, that's not gratuitous. We really did have a good time playing every concert, and each of them had their own flavour from our point of view, and also in terms of the venue and the audience. And it was a really, really fun couple of weeks.
Now, did you have a build up to the tour? Or?
No, I mean, well, in terms of organising the tour, I mean, it was something that I had been working on for quite a while. You know, I mean, it takes a while to organise these things. And in terms of a build-up as a band, I mean, not really. I mean, the nature of our band with Remco living in Amsterdam is that every year or so he sort of breezes in, and we get a short amount of time to prepare and get to know each other again, and then do what we do, which is generally go on the road in one manner of speaking or another.
I wanted to ask you conceptually how you modelled this band. Was it on any particular band in jazz history with the trombone and the saxophone?
No. I mean, you know, there's plenty of front lines, there's plenty of precedents, but we didn't consciously and hopefully unconsciously really sort of focus on any one of them. We just Remco and I wanted to do something together, and initially we got together and brought to the project songs that we'd had individually for other projects that weren't necessarily the same front line at all. And over time, we sort of tried to develop something that, you know, on a band sound and, you know, recording as we did last year and releasing this CD and then touring with the band this year is helping to do that more and more. And I think hopefully, in the near future, as we work to another recording and another tour and all that sort of stuff, it'll consolidate a little bit more.
The other guys in the band, Matt McMahon, very, very experienced piano player and playing the Fender Rhodes in this instance, Mike Majowski on the acoustic bass, and James Hauptman on the drums. So a mix of the youngsters there and someone in their 30s that's quite experienced.
Yeah, and I suppose, I mean, if you include Remco and myself into the mix, it's a pretty even spread from Matt's age down to, I'm not sure who's younger, James or Mike, you know. So we sort of fill that whole spectrum there. And I guess in terms of playing experience, you know, there's variables there too. But it works well, I think. You know, we get along together very well, personally, you know. We'll all enjoy playing with each other. It seems to mix quite naturally.
GC4CP. Now, what do those initials stand for?
Yeah. This is a major story in each gig if anyone's ever been to one of our concerts. This is one of Remco's compositions, and it's something he's had for a little while. It existed before this band, and it's basically about one of the stints that he spent in New York. I'm not sure. He was living with Chris Potter's girlfriend or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, they became friends, and Remco likes cooking, and he enjoyed making a green curry for Chris Potter.
Where did you grow up, Lucien? What early influences formed your first impressions towards music?
I'm sorry to say that I come from a family of pianists. My mother and father met at the Canberra School of Music, mm-hmm. and I was born while they were students there. I don't know if it's still true, but I know when I eventually ended up studying there, which I guess was bound to happen, but when I eventually ended up studying there, there was still staff at the conservatorium there that remembered me from a very young age. And as I remembered them, those were probably my first impressions, absolutely. My parents practicing the piano and their musical tastes.
These days you have quite a wide breadth of jazz that crosses your path. You know, you've worked with the Jazz Groove Mothership Orchestra, inventive big bands, original contemporary groups, funk outfits, and I see you're also playing with Jeff Bull in a couple of weeks' time. Is that right? Down at the Classic Jazz?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Festival down at Bowral.
Yep, that's right.
Probably a New Orleans type sound there.
Yeah, well, that's a specific set for the festival there that includes sort of early dance music from New Orleans and Sedalia and sort of centers of dance music at the turn of the century in the south of the United States.
How difficult is it really to cross genres as seamlessly as that?
It's really hard to say. I guess, you know, it's about how informed you are. I had a conversation with James Greening about this or something like this a little while ago. And in a lot of ways, as time goes on and media prevails in so many different ways and the immediacy of media, and a lot of us are becoming more and more informed, at least, you know, have a kind of an acquaintance with more and more genres of music and art and media, you know, in modern times than, say, you know, when radio was the only thing around, you know.
Mm.
So, and I guess musicians these days sort of try as hard as they can to be as informed as possible about as many different kinds of music as possible, you know.
Would it be an economic requirement too?
Yeah, well, I guess how far that you go with that, how far that takes you or how far you take it, would probably have a lot to do with, you know, what kind of things you get offered and which things snowball and you do more of and which things... for one reason or another, you don't do so much of, you know. For my part, 4 or 5 years ago, I would have been playing a much higher proportion of Latin music, which I love, and I do almost none of that right now. That may change later on this year, or I don't know. But yeah. You know, that stuff definitely happens for sure.
It's quite easy to look back, I guess. And when I was thinking about this afternoon, you know, take Lee Konitz for example. Not predictable, but you knew what the type of sound that he stood for, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
These days, well, let's take Phil Slater for example. He's heading a group. It could be quite different to how you saw him 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose that's true. I sometimes wonder if Australians or Australian musicians do that more than most, because of a couple of things. You know, we're servicing a small audience, comparatively speaking, to say, you know, a larger first world economic country, or trying to sort of cover a few bases and explore different things as they come as often as possible.
Back to your band now, and musically the relationship with Remco Kaiser, the saxophonist with the group, seems to be a very special one. In my own case, with good friends, you can be apart sometimes for as little as a few months or even a few years with no communication, and then all of a sudden you meet one another again and you just pick up where it leaves off. Now, does that happen musically?
Does that happen musically? That's a really good question. I think, for me, personal relationships and musical relationships, very similar. And maybe that's just how I perceive it, but Remco and I are just like that. You know, we often don't see each other for at least 6 or 9 months at a time. And then, you know, it's always comfortable and natural as soon as we see each other again. And then when it comes to the playing, I think because of that, I don't really give it a second thought. I'm set up to enjoy it. I want it to be the best it can be and as enjoyable as it can be. And I think we both head straight to that place. So it might actually have changed in terms of what's happening with the music, but because of the, you know, because we both have that mindset, it just kind of flows.
The trombone has always had an image problem. But does that lack of good players around actually make it easier to get gigs?
No, not at all, no. No, I mean, I don't know if that's really true. I mean, there's so many good players around, really.
I have my own Downbeat database at home where I can go back through Downbeats to, say, the late 1980s, and I can see who's been on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I could not find one trombonist on the cover of Downbeat for all those years. So, you know, I had to go to, like, page 4 or 5 or, you know...
Sure.
To find someone.
Yeah.
That's why I mentioned that.
Mm.
And there would have to be a lot more saxophonists, even, for example, here in Sydney, than there is trombonists.
I'm sure there is a lot more people, sure, you know. I'm sure a lot of, you know, it's probably like economics, you know, supply and demand. A good friend of mine, Jeremy Borthwick, is, you know, I mean, all the friends I've mentioned so far are trombone players. Jeremy was we were talking about some students today, you know, students that we have and students that we've had in the past. And, you know, he made a really good point, which is, you know, quite a few of his best students, most promising high school students, for one reason or another, don't didn't pursue it past high school, you know. They went on to do economics degrees or whatever. I guess that's the same for an instrument. You know, there's lots of talented people, and whether they're actually visible or not might have to do with choices they make or what else they've got going on or how they choose to sort of interact with the music scene. Pigus is my composition. It's one of the few things I've written directly concerning a subject, and the subject here is a friend of mine that I met, funnily enough, while I was living in Amsterdam. He's from Greece, and we were housemates for a while, and he's a very, very enigmatic person. His name's Nicholas Pigus.
Is Lucien McGuinness. This afternoon, Lucien, I was checking out some of the old Downbeat magazines, and I came across an article and an interview with the preeminent jazz trombonist, J.J. Johnson. In 1997, he said, what counts is you play some every day, including Christmas, Thanksgiving and New Year's Day, even if it's 10 minutes. What counts is the everydayness of it. How often do you practice and maintain your chops? And is the trombone more demanding than the trumpet?
I can't answer the last question. I don't know, because I don't play the trumpet. But I know J.J. Johnson, you know, he mentioned from time to time that he found the trombone demanding, which is, I mean, you know, he's the guy that everybody thinks of first. So that's amazing that he's willing to admit that. How much work I do changes all the time, depending on what other stuff I've got going on in my life, you know. I tend to have a lot of fingers in a lot of pies in general.
I know what you mean.
Which my wife actually hates, but, you know, that's what I do. And someone was telling me about the musical excellence. I can't remember who wrote it. There was a study, Dave Panicki talks about this sometimes, there was a study that basically came out with a number, and it said 10,000 hours is the minimum needed to achieve musical excellence on an instrument. And if you break it down, I mean, that's 10 years of 3 hours a day without fail every day. And every day that falls back to 1.5 is another day. You know, so you're talking a lot of time.
That's incredible.
You know, and I think the reality is all musicians of all levels spend an enormous amount of time building their craft, you know. And, you know, I don't think it's anyone's duty to acknowledge that. But to a certain point, sometimes I think it's really worth pointing out. The time of the 2000 Olympics, I really felt strongly about. If I had some money, I would have taken out some full-page advertisements pointing out that some of the great musicians, older Australian musicians, have spent a lifetime training much harder, or as hard and much longer than most professional sportsmen. You know, they don't retire at 35 when their knees give out. You know,
they don't retire, do they?
They don't retire. They play and practice and play and improve and work and practice for years and decades, half a century, if not more.
Sonny Rollins
is a good example. I saw him play, you know, a little while ago. It's amazing. The new conductor in residence for the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, Vladimir Ashkenazy, 72. And I saw him on the TV the other day, and he was going at it with full gusto, you know, absolutely committed physically and mentally and emotionally, you know, to the job of being a musician, you know. And there's no doubt that he's put in an enormous amount of hours. He probably already had became a professional pianist, you know, in his early 20s. Mm. Anyone who can play any kind of music, you know, much less the guys, you know, let alone the guys that can play lots of kinds of music really well, you know, everyone's put a lot of work in. There's no doubt about it. There's no other way around it.
Thanks very much for coming into the studio tonight, Lucien.
Thanks so much, Frank.